For the week of February 5th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 135, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And back in New York, thank God, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, wait a second. Thank good God. Where were you? I mean, I know you've been traveling for 2 weeks.
I was on the road for 2 weeks. I was in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Then I went to Birmingham, Alabama. Then Atlanta, Georgia. Then Jacksonville, Florida. Then St. Petersburg, Florida. Then Naples, Florida, right down at the bottom. Then all the way back up to Tampa. And then Birmingham. And then Nashville, Tennessee. Then back to Allentown for a snowboarding competition. Way to go, Justin. And he won his second heat. And now I'm finally back in New York. I got back late Sunday night. So I missed everything. I missed the American holiday of all time, the Super Bowl.
What?
Yeah, I didn't even tape it. I wasn't back in time. I didn't tape it. I didn't watch any commercials. I watched a few things online after the fact, you know, because now you can watch the halftime show. You can watch the commercials. You can watch anything you want on a click of a button. But I did miss the whole hoopla. So I missed, you know, the great ceremony.
Well, now, wait a second. So then you weren't one of the, what do you think it was, 110 million people watching this show?
That'd be about right, about 110 million. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't set any records. Last year, there were 111 million people who watched the Pittsburgh Steelers versus the Green Bay Packers, and the Green Bay Packers won 31-25. This year, it was the New York Giants versus the New England Patriots, a repeat of, was it Super Bowl? I can't remember what year it was, 2007, I want to say.
You're asking the wrong guy.
Okay, well, so American football, the biggest championship game, Super Bowl, happened last night, and it really is one of the most watched shows, if not the most watched television show of the year.
Right, and depending if you want to be negative, they say the ratings were down from last year, or you can say it's the third highest rated Super Bowl game in history, which sounds a little better.
Here's my opinion on it. Okay, so the year before, 2011, you had, 111 million people watch. It was the most watched television show in history. Okay, this year, you're just a half a tick behind. You have 110 million people watch, maybe? Okay, so if you're an advertiser, who cares? You have 110 million people watching your advertisement.
Well, they don't care. They know perfectly well it was a great game and reached their audience. They're not upset. Though I have to say, the commercials in general, I've been over them for the last few years. They're too aware of the event status. They're too desperate to make a big sort of splash. I haven't been excited by the creativity. And I think the fun has officially completely gone out of it. There's too much pre-buzz, too many leaks of commercials online before the show, like the Matthew Broderick one, which frankly was better in its online version at 2.5 minutes rather than the edited version that aired in the third quarter. There's too much instant polling. It's just, you don't feel like you're discovering anything. It feels way, way too corporatized and too self-aware to be fun anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. Having them air beforehand is, and they don't really air. They appear on YouTube or they leak.
They leak.
Yeah, they get leaked. Yeah, air quotes. I think you need. Yeah, well, but in any case, I think that it kind of takes some of the thrill over. And like, what commercial is going to be next? I agree with you. None of the commercials were huge standouts. There were a few funny ones, without a doubt, but nothing like. I guess it's probably one of the greatest commercials of all time. Of course, there's the Apple commercial from 1984 for the Macintosh. And then there's the Mean Joe Green commercial for, is it Coca-Cola or Pepsi? Where he's
Coca-Cola.
Yeah. And so those are like classic commercials. And I don't think, because you can do so much now on television and the internet, you don't have to put your entire ad out there in a 30-second spot. People are getting lazy. And I know that they spend a lot of time and effort on this, but it seems like the ads are much lazier.
Well, I just think it's more like they're all trying to create a big summer blockbuster and ending up with Transformers 3 rather than something distinctive and personal that can actually resonate in a fun, fresh way. They're all desperate to be that blockbuster and sort of programmed in talking animals, this, that, and the other thing, whatever's trendy at the moment. So you end up with anonymous summer fare rather than a great personal movie that somebody was dying to make, which is where great commercials and great art come from. Not that those two always go together, but at least the halftime show. What did you think?
Did you see the halftime show?
I just watched it online.
Okay, so I thought, my God, first of all, I'm Madonna, neither here nor there. I think she's very talented for what she does. I'm a little shocked that she got away with, naming her album MDNA, which is the code word or the scientific term for ecstasy.
And it's Madonna DNA, and it's Madonna MD. It's great on many levels.
Yeah, it's needless to say, I thought the halftime show was really pretty spectacular. I did not like the fact that she pretty much lip synced I don't know what the past tense is, through most of it. You could definitely tell.
Oh, no, of course. I think if she wanted to be really radical, I think the cool, rebellious thing to do would be just get rid of the prop microphones. Don't even pretend. We all know you're lip syncing, baby. Just rip them off. Even like at the beginning of the song, rip them and just go end this charade. Because we all know you aren't singing, which is fine. Because when you're doing a big elaborate dance number, people can't sing at the same time necessarily. So, hey, you know.
She did sing some of it live. And yeah, you could hear
little,
it.
Very little.
You could hear
it. You knew
difference.
When it was.
Yeah. I mean,
so bring out the mic for that moment, and that would make it fun. You know, just be like, you know, and end the charade. I think people are too smart for that.
You know, I think a lot of people were shocked. Oh my gosh, this person's 53 years old. She's been doing this for 30 years.
Well, yeah, she's been around a long time. She's a star. And she had MIA, obviously, who shot the middle finger at the end of her little bit. You had Nicki Minaj, you had CeeLo Green. So Madonna brought out the Young Turks to, you know, show her cred and show she could bring up onto the stage anyone she wanted. I think her backup dancers have never worn so much clothing. They all had, they were very family friendly, except for the little middle finger.
Yeah, and well, and you had to know MIA, who is this kind of electronica rap artist, hip hop artist. She was going to do something. She's kind of a provocateur, if you will.
Well, and, yeah, but that's Madonna's job. I don't know if she appreciated it.
Well, that's
she'd be
what
like,
I mean.
Hey, I don't want them talking about MIA, baby.
And I'll be honest, they popped those people up. I wasn't, frankly, so much was going on. I didn't even know who those people were. So I didn't realize that was MIA. Otherwise, nor did I notice the whole middle finger thing until it was on the news later.
Well, so it was a body part malfunction. But there you go. That's the Super Bowl. So there you go. I missed it, but I'm back in town, settling back in, and I didn't even get to go to the weekend box office.
You know, well, okay. Well, I'm going to get into what before we move on from the Super Bowl. A couple of points. The halftime show was technically spectacular. I mean, they had these screens and made the whole stage
look really good.
Look 3D. That was phenomenal. But okay, so musical acts. During the show, they could not, NBC, you know, it was on NBC, they couldn't have enough advertisements for Smash, which is this this show we've talked about in the past. It's a Steven Spielberg production about a Broadway show being put together. And then, of course, The Voice, which followed the Super Bowl. And I've never really watched The Voice. However, I got my Rolling Stone magazine on Thursday or Friday, and the hosts of The Voice were all on it. You had Adam Levine.
Were they on the cover?
On the cover.
Well, isn't that sad? Isn't that a sad commentary that a TV singing competition like that would be on the cover of Rolling Stone? Far cry from, you know, Lou Reed.
Well, be that as it may, you know, you have CeeLo Green, who was also, by the way, on stage with Madonna last night.
Yeah.
You had...
whatever. Did you watch it? Did you like it?
I did watch it. Christina Aguilera.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I have to say... It's a really good show. They bring these people out.
We all know what it is. You're the only one who doesn't. Our old friend Karen Woodward also watched the show, and she liked it. She'd never watched it before either. So they may have won quite a few new fans. It certainly did better than Glee did last year for Fox. That followed the Super Bowl, which is one of the worst post-Super Bowl combinations you can think of. Yes, let's show Glee after the Super Bowl. That's something that's counter-programming, you idiots. This year, they did the Voice family programming, and it worked very well for them. So, hey, you know, this is one reason why American Idol is down from last year. It still has been the number one show in the country, but it's not been doing great in the audition period. Maybe this will change things. The Voice got a big boost. And, you know, between The Voice and The X Factor, there's a lot of talent competition weariness. And this could be the thing that helps to be the nail in the coffin to not have Idol be number one anymore. You know, we'll have to see as the weeks fold out.
Well, yeah, and I think what I like about The Voice, and I know I'm the last person on the face of the planet.
It's not that big. I'm just saying we know what it is. It's a talent competition. They're there. They blind audition the people so you don't look at them. You just hear the voice, et cetera.
Well,
and then
no,
they champion their own people.
Right, exactly. They have to pick, and then they switch the...
like the X Factor.
Right, but then they actually have the contestant. If, like, let's say two, CeeLo Green and Christina Aguilera.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they then turn the table and the contestant has to say, well, I'll go with CeeLo Green instead of Christina Aguilera. That's kind of a little ingenious. Kind of like our show today is a little ingenious. In fact, on today's show, we're going to be talking to Jonathan Handel, who is an entertainment attorney at Troy Gould in Los Angeles and a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. He's kind of like our attorney in residence here at Showbiz Sandbox. We always go to him when we have some kind of legal questions to answer. And today, he's going to be filling us in on why two of Hollywood's biggest unions may be merging. We've got the latest updates on the awards season. A few more awards were handed out over the weekend. There's a smattering of music news. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But, well, I guess second in this case. We turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the number one movie at the box office worldwide is Chronicle, the indie film. I don't know how to describe this, but a small film about high school teenagers who get superpowers and have a lot of fun until one of them starts to use them for more nefarious purposes.
Well, this whole new concept of found footage.
No, I don't even know what that means.
Well, meaning like Paranormal Activity. It's like, oh,
no, it's not found footage. It's a mock documentary style where they pretend to be filming stuff. It's not found footage. Found footage is a film like Decasia, where you take actual found footage and create a film out of it. This is a movie that's done in a faux documentary style.
Well,
Blair Witch Project is not found footage. They weren't really in the woods. It's not a genre. It's not a thing. They just used shaky cameras and stuff to pretend that they were filming themselves doing it.
Okay, well, first of all, in case you're wondering, LA Times, New York Times, Hollywood,
they're all wrong.
Hollywood Reporter,
they're all wrong.
All labeled it as found footage.
Well,
genre.
They're idiots, and they're following a 2 minute trend of calling something the found footage genre. Give me a break. It's a mock documentary style. You know, it's not a genre. There's no such thing as a found footage genre. It's just a stupid label that they've come up with for this week's batch of movies because they want to say something different.
Well, it cost $12 million to make. It made $35 million worldwide. Not bad.
That's great. It's what shocks me is that it made $35 million worldwide. I mean, this is a movie with no stars in it. I mean, they're kids who've been in, like Dane DeHaan, who've been in True Blood and the HBO series In Treatment. They've all got some credits, basically, and they're all good-looking young people. But it was an incredibly good launch in North America and overseas. It's the sort of movie you would launch it in one country, and if it did really well, that would help you sell it elsewhere because it's an unknown quantity. But in this case, they opened it up, you know, in a number of other countries, and it did really well. So, you know, it's tripled its budget worldwide in one weekend, and that's just amazing. Number two at the box office worldwide is Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, the Tom Cruise film. It grossed $27 million worldwide. It's at $627 million worldwide total. Not only is it the number one Mission Impossible film in the franchise, it is now the number one Tom Cruise film of all time.
Though that is a figure, number one at the box office, and those are not adjusted for inflation. So, and they're not realized gross, meaning, you know, you're not taking all of Top Gun's DVD sales into account and stuff.
DVD
like
that. Is not a part of a box office gross.
Right. Okay. So that's why
know that we're talking about box office. It's his highest grossing box office film of all time. And no, we're not adjusting for inflation.
Right. Exactly.
That, no, we never do. Most people never do. Those numbers are very difficult to come by. So that would be malarkey. Sure. He had big hits in the 80s as well. If we had ticket sales, not prices, that would be the best comparison. Can't do it. It's his biggest film of all time. Still a major accomplishment for a guy that 2 or 3, 4 or 5 years ago, oh, he jumped on the couch. He'll never be a big star again. And I believe we on our show said, you're all idiots. He's still a big star.
Yes.
But anyway, number three at the box office worldwide is The Woman in Black. This is the Daniel Radcliffe film based on a classic horror tale or thriller. I don't know how to describe it. It grossed $21 million in North America. I don't have overseas figures. I guess it opened up here before it opened up in the UK, which is its natural home. This is a terrific debut. It's another step towards Daniel Radcliffe putting Harry Potter behind him. You know, he had a big Broadway hit, and now he's got a genuine hit movie. It was picked up for $3 million, so it's definitely a big score for the distributor, CBS Films. And this is a big success. It's based on a play, in part, the play is based on a novel as well, that's been running in the West End for a long, long time. Not as long as The Mousetrap, but it's a long-running hit. And I think this will just boost the prospects of that play. People will start to go see it when they go to London again. Not that they haven't been already. At number four worldwide is Underworld Awakening, another $17 million. That's at $108 million and counting. At number five is the George Clooney film The Descendants at $15 million worldwide. It's now at $110 million. And I would say of all the movies that have received Oscar nominations, this one has capitalized the most. I never thought it would have had any more room to grow in North America, but it's still grossing $4 million a week on a weekend, which is great for a movie like this size. And it really opened up strongly overseas, capitalizing on all the attention that the Oscar nominations got it. I mean, it's George Clooney, but this is a small, intimate drama, and they've really turned this into a successful
film. And it's kind of a downbeat film. I mean, it's not a...
Yeah, it's not a happy, happy film. It's about his wife is in a coma dying.
Right. And, you know, slow and steady wins the race, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, they've done a great job with that. Number six is Journey to the Mysterious Island, the sequel to Journey to the Center of the Earth. It's been opening up overseas. It grossed another $14 million. It's at $41 million and counting and doing great in the markets where it's open.
Now, so, can I just say something about this?
Please.
It has not opened here yet in the U.S.
That's right.
And This just goes to the power of advertising because my kids, ages almost 7 and 5.5 want to see this movie, and every time they pass a poster, even if it's out of the corner of their eye, if there's a poster for this film, they see it and go, oh, we really want to see that movie. And I'm saying, why? You don't know anything about this movie.
you apparently don't know anything about children. That's
maybe
how it works.
That might be true. Just ask my kids.
Well, it stars Josh Hutcherson, who was in who's in The Hunger Games. So this is a big, big year for him. He's in The Hunger Games. He was in Red Dawn, which never got released. Someday, maybe it will. He's in this. He's in. He was in The Kids Are All Right. He was. You know, he's having a great run here. So he's really building up as a strong young actor. And it opens February 10th in North America. So your kids will only have to wait a little bit longer. It is family friendly. It stars Dwayne The Rock Johnson. So I hope you'll take them to it and make them happy. And number 7 is The Gray, the Liam Neeson action film. It grossed another $11 million worldwide. It's at $36 million and counting. It started to open up a little bit overseas, I think in Russia. And this has fallen hard and fast. It will not have the legs of Taken or his previous, you know, adventure action film.
Yeah, it dropped 52%. And if you look at it, okay, that film came in number 3 here in the U.S., 52% down. Number 5 was Underworld Awakening, down 54%. Number 6, One for the Money, down 54%. Red Tails, number 7,
well,
down 52%.
Percentage drops are meaningless. If it was made $200 million its opening weekend, it wouldn't matter what percentage it dropped. You'd say, what a great thing, it made another $100 million.
You didn't even let me finish. I was going to go all the way down to, and guess what? Ticket sales this weekend, even though with all these films dropping sometimes over 50%, up 37%. On a weekend when most people don't even go to the movies on Sunday.
Well, that's why you shouldn't be looking at percentage drops. It's way overplayed as far as a barometer of health. The fact is the Super Bowl weekend's a terrible weekend for movies, especially on Sunday in North America. And we've had two very strong openings, Chronicle and The Woman in Black, and it'll be a lot of fun to see what sort of legs they have. I'm intrigued to see that. And number 8 is a movie that does not have legs. It's Man on a Ledge. That grossed another $10 million. It's at $24 million and counting. And number 9 is a French film, Would I Lie to You? It grossed $10 million in France alone. It's third in a series of comedies about, and you're going to love this, rambunctious textile merchants. I can't wait to see that open up in North America.
Ah, oui.
But the French are really on fire at the box office lately. And number 10 is Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, another $10 million worldwide. That's at just under $500 million and counting with Japan to come. Number 11 is Big Miracle, another North American debut. It grossed $8.5 million. This is the whale movie with Drew Barrymore and the guy from The Office. A poor showing, especially for a movie that looked like perfect counter-programming for the Super Bowl. You know, it was appealed to women, animals, family-friendly. So this has to be a bit of a disappointment for them, whereas Chronicle and The Woman in Black did just terrifically well. At number 11? No, he did that. Number 12, Jack and Jill, the Adam Sandler comedy. That's his worst outing, basically, since Little Nicky back in 2000. It goes to $8 million overseas, but it's really not doing that well. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Untouchables, did another $7 million. That's the French comedy we've talked about a lot. It's grossed $186 million, basically in France and Germany alone. It's a monster, and it's coming to Lincoln Center in March. It opens the Rendezvous with French Cinema Festival, so I'm looking forward to hopefully seeing that. Then you have One for the Money, Red Tails, Extremely Loud, Contraband. At number 19 is The Artist. This is the front runner, some people believe, for the Oscar Best Picture. It grossed another $2.5 million. It's at $47 million worldwide and counting, including $20 million in the U.S. And hey, at least that's more than The Hurt Locker, which only grossed $17 million. I still feel like, you know, it's doing pretty well. And for the type of movie it is, it's doing great. It's an art house project, basically, and it's at $20 million. That's a very strong performance. But for a Best Picture winner, I think it's still a little weak and has not exploded in popularity. It's doing good, but it has not capitalized on the nomination so much that it would, I think, give them the courage to say, yes, yes, this is our Best Picture. It's not playing in the heartland terribly well. It's very much a coastal picture, East Coast and West Coast.
Right, right.
If there's a vulnerability, I think it's still there. But $20 million is pretty respectable for a black and white, essentially silent film. So we'll have to see.
Right. And I think, you know, it's a shame, though, because I think if it doesn't win Best Picture, you know, its financial success, you know, it'll just be seen as a disappointment, I think.
Like, well, I can't imagine getting all those nominations. It might win Best Actor. You know, it might win something else if it doesn't win Best Picture. He could be an upset in Best Actor. Or screenplay. It would be crazy to call it a disappointment because it didn't win Best Picture. It would be the first foreign film in history to win Best Picture. So it is already a big success story as far as I'm concerned. But we'll have to see. I didn't get to see any movies over the weekend. I was too busy.
Well,
but you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, Hugo, I think, is coming out to be kind of the front runner at this point for best
Hugo?
Picture.
Absolutely not.
You don't think so? So it's if it's not
I
Hugo.
I would say The Descendants, I think. Okay. It's the dark horse because it's doing really well at the box office. And it won all virtually every nomination it could except Best Supporting Actress. Hugo, again, could have won Best Supporting Actor. It's mostly in the tech area that it scored so many nominations, whereas The Descendants was strong across the board.
Well, certainly the front runner in the animated award category, best animated feature, is Rango, in my opinion.
I think you're right. It's hard to tell. It's one of those quirky categories where not everybody votes. So it's, you know, it's hard to tell. But certainly it won the top award at the Annie Awards, which is the big annual animation awards. Are Disney movies eligible for that anymore? Are they still boycotting that? Or Disney and Pixar, whatever they were doing?
I think they are still boycotting it. But I think they still keep winning. So it doesn't, I don't think it matters that they're boycotting.
What do you mean?
I think they're still nominated at times, aren't they? Kung Fu Panda.
That's DreamWorks.
Oh, okay. Then what do I know? I mean,
I don't believe they put them up for nomination. They're not members and they're not nominated. Not that Cars 2 would have won, but there you go. So that's a good little thing for that one. For Rango, that's certainly a movie you want to check out on DVD.
It is. I have to say, it's not a movie for kids because I took my kids to see it. They were so confused. They had no idea what was going on. But meanwhile, the adults in the audience loved it.
Well, you mean like it would be good for 12-year-olds. It's just not good for 5 or 7-year-olds.
Yeah. Okay. Good point. Yes.
Okay. I mean, it's not inappropriate.
No. It's not inappropriate. It's just too confusing.
Right. It's sort of an homage to spaghetti westerns and other things. It's a little more sophisticated, talky adult type storyline rather than animals and cars.
Yes. Correct.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I have it on DVD. Haven't watched it yet. But, you know, I want to see it before the Oscars come out. And when the Oscars do come out, when we have the awards ceremony, Kodak may not be on the name of the theater.
Yes, I think it's going to be on the name of the theater this year. It's going to be next year whether it's going to be on the name of the theater. Now, in the around 1999, 2000, 2001, Hollywood and Highland, which is very close to Hollywood and Vine, the infamous corner here in or famous corner, I don't know whether you want to call it infamous or famous, where stars get discovered on the corner of Hollywood and Vine here in Hollywood. Well, just down the street, they built this whole kind of mall complex, and in it was a theater, a big giant theater built specifically for the Academy Awards. Kodak got the naming rights. They're paying $4 million a year for the naming rights.
And then we all bought digital cameras.
That's right. And now they don't have $4 million to pay. So the deal that they signed was for 20 years, and it was worth $75 million. They paid their latest installment, so it'll be called the Kodak Theater for at least a little while. But the company, which filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy recently, said, we'd really like to get out of this deal where we pay you $4 million to name the theater after a company that may not be around in a week. So now I guess they're going to get out of their deal. And guess who else is trying to get out of their deal with the Kodak Theater?
Well, not necessarily. This is the Academy Awards themselves. They have a contract and they have an opt-out clause after 10 years. And so they've technically notified them, hey, we may not renew after our 10-year opt-out clause to have the Academy Awards at that theater, now known as the Kodak Theater. It may be a negotiating ploy, maybe a serious desire to move elsewhere. It's ideally spaced for them. It's good space. Everything's right for them. It's designed for them. So I think they'll probably end up staying, but they're, you know, playing hardball in their negotiations.
Yeah, I mean, if you have ever visited this theater, there's a whole walkway. It's right next to the Grauman Chinese Theater, that infamous, or what is it with
why,
me?
And why the, do, what if you and your infamous?
I don't know, infamous. The famous.
Beloved.
You know, the beloved theater where everybody goes and puts their handprints in the, you know, sidewalk outside. There's this nice corridor going through to the theater with all of the best pictures listed out. I mean, if you took the Academy Awards away from there, you'd have to redesign the whole complex.
I don't know why.
Well, I guess, yeah, maybe you wouldn't, but it certainly is well.
Now, I'll tell you, you and I have covered events like this. I've never covered the Oscars, but I've covered other awards events. Trust me, if they offered me a ticket to be a reporter backstage or just to watch it at home, I'd rather watch it at home.
Oh, my
gosh. If they asked me to be in the audience, I'd rather watch it at home. It's a better way to experience it.
I've done both, and I can tell you that, you know, certainly trying to cover this event backstage, it's like a juggling act. You've got people standing in front of you who have just won awards, and they're, you know, being asked questions, and you're in a room full of 500 reporters. Meanwhile, on the television sets overhead and in your earphones that you're listening to, you know, you're listening to the telecast, you're trying to take notes on what the the winner has said, not only on television, but the winner standing in front of it's a nightmare. I decidedly stopped covering it because it's so exasperating.
Yeah. Well, my point is, if we had the choice, we would rather stay at home and do it. But the question is for moviegoers, if you had the choice, if a movie was playing in your theater on Friday night, if you could have seen Chronicle in your home on video on demand, would that make you less likely to go see it in the theater? Or would it make you more likely? Would you to watch more movies and consume more stuff and just chose movie by movie? You know, what would happen if we just broke down all those windows and said, hey, when a movie comes out at the box office, we know you're stealing the movie, so let's just make it available via video on demand or streaming or DVD or all this sort of stuff and let you decide which way you want to consume your film. Would that have any impact on how much money you spent and how many movies you saw?
Well, that's a good question, and it's also the question that Richard Greenfield over at BTIG Research asked in a recent survey. Now
I never heard of BTIG.
Well, we've talked about them in the past. We definitely have. They are a kind of an investment bank research firm. And so they're very focused on business and very focused on specifically public companies. And Richard Greenfield for a long time has been saying to movie studios through his blog at BTIG Research, hey, abolish windows. And so he went out and he did this poll.
And by windows, you mean saying a movie comes out in a theater and then 3 months later it comes out on DVD and a month after that it comes out on video on demand and 2 months after that on Hulu and then 2 months after that on Time Warner Cable, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, because basically for him, as somebody working at an investment bank, all he cares about is, hey, you know what? I'm investing in Viacom. I'm investing in Paramount or Sony. I need these companies to do as well as they can. And one way to do that is to get rid of these windows. So he's trying to see...
No, that doesn't make any sense. Everybody wants the companies to do as well as they can. The argument is, what is the best way? It's not that he's saying, gee, I want you to make more money. You've just got to do this. The argument is whether that would make them more money. He right. says it would, but that's not because he wants them to be profitable. That's because he's just arguing for this philosophy that it would make more money.
Right. And I guess in the end, I don't know that, you know, he did this survey, you know, 1,200 people were polled. I don't necessarily know that so much was found. You know, was anything conclusive here?
Well, that's very, you know, a bunch of data gets very confusing. I'd like to know who his clients are. Does he have clients who deal with video streaming and video on demand? And, who, you know, I'd like to know if he's backed by people that have a stake in having smaller windows or shorter windows collapse. But anyway, the ultimate argument that he makes in this thing where he polled people, if a movie was there in the theater, would you pay $20 to watch a video on demand, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. His basic final argument was, look, we look at overall and we say, quote, well, not, it's not a quote, but if you would collapse all these windows and just make everything available, you'd probably see a little more spending by consumers and more of that would be captured by studios and exhibitors. And it would offset, in part, at worst, a rise in piracy. There's always piracy. There'd probably be a little bit more if these things were available day and date, though I don't see why, because there's already so much piracy already. But he says, if you make everything available right away in any possible way that someone wants to watch it, you'll make more money.
Right, and actually what he was saying is not that exhibitors would make more money.
Everybody. Well, the studios and
The studios would make more money versus the movie exhibitors. The movie, you know, movie exhibitors would kind of make a little bit less money, but not a whole heck of a lot less.
Do you think that's true? Do you think if we just collapsed everything and made everything available all at once, which would be a radical reorganization of the business and how it promotes movies every step of the way, do you think that would be a good thing or a smart thing? Do you think that would raise revenue or keep it the same or decrease it?
It's kind of like... I think that it certainly would raise revenue. No doubt it would raise revenue.
No doubt?
Yes.
You're sure? You're sure it would. If I could rent a movie video on demand for $5 and I don't have to go to the theater and spend $12, that's going to raise revenue.
Well, it's going to raise revenue for the...
And 10 people can watch it with me.
Well, it's going to raise revenue because instead of trying to download it for free online...
No. You're not... The idea that this is to stop people from pirating is not true. It's the people who are paying for good stuff. How will they respond to these new availabilities? That they're the people going to stop pirating. The people are not pirating because, you know, oh, damn it, if only you'd make it available to me at home, I would do that. This is malarkey. All these people who see movies on opening weekend in their home, they're not saying, well, gee, I would have loved to spend money, but I just couldn't. They just want to see movies for free.
Well, right. And I think that you know, there's also people like me who go, well, gee, I'd really like to see Chronicle, but I was, you know, busy during the all-media screening, and I don't have time to go to the movie theater now. But you know what? For $15, I might rent it. I might rent it and put it on the TV and watch it there because I can do it on my time.
You wouldn't have heard of Chronicle because
there's the rub.
Wouldn't have a big box office.
That's where I was headed, and that's exactly right. the movie theater experience and the movie theater window is really a giant marketing tool for all of the other
ancillary. $10 billion grossing marketing tool. It's not exactly, you know, a loss leader.
In huge, big blockbuster events, I think like Transformers, for instance, it is a huge moneymaker and a marketing tool. I think for smaller films, it can sometimes be a marketing tool that breaks even and as a way of showing.
Again, it's not a marketing tool. It's a way to make money.
Well, a lot of these independent films, they'll release theatrically, break even theatrically, knowing that they're only going to break even theatrically, so that they're taken more seriously by Walmart.
You're not talking about the big Hollywood movies that get ripped off all the time.
No. I'm talking about smaller films, much smaller
films. Right. Well, people are ripping off The Hangover 2. They're not going to the tiny French film with subtitles. I mean, the people do rip those off too, but we're talking about people ripping off Hangover 2, movies they know they want to see. Piracy is a problem. It's not solved by making things available day and date in your home. People are not ripping them off because they can't stream it immediately. They're ripping them off because they don't want to pay.
Yeah, I think in part that's true. I do think in part there are some people who, you know...
There's not a massive amount of people refusing to go to the... I refuse to go to the theaters, but I want to spend billions of dollars on movies every year. If only you would make it available via streaming.
No, for me, it's not a matter of I don't want to go to the movie theater. It's that I don't have time as somebody with two children to go to the movie theater.
That's why you rent DVDs and the millions of video on demand that are already available now.
And that is exactly why I do that. For instance, Margin Call. Would have loved to have seen that in the movie theater. Would have loved to have seen that at Sundance. I missed it, but I watched it on VOD.
But it didn't have to be available. You can be watching Margin Call now.
Right.
You didn't have to be available the day it was in theaters. I'm saying there's plenty of movies to stream and watch on DVD all the time.
That's right.
It may not be the movie that's in the box office theater this week. It may not be Chronicle, but that's okay.
But now here's the rub. I watched Margin Call. It had already been out for about 3 weeks, right?
Yeah.
I watched it. It was in theaters. I watched it at VOD, and I was a part of the conversation. And I liked that. I paid for it, but I liked it.
You would have been part of the conversation when it came out on DVD 6 weeks later.
Possibly.
For God's sakes, whatever. Because we've talked too much about this.
You're right. That may have worked for 40 or 50 years. However, the world has changed, and I don't need to buy a stamp now to send a letter. I can do it via email. So it's time to maybe shift our thinking and shift the business models. That's not going to happen overnight, as we saw in the music industry, which is our next story about Spotify and what their royalty rate is and how really they're bringing royalty rates down for music artists.
They're bringing down the amount of money artists make, you're saying?
Yes.
They're adding to the money artists make, but artists saying they're not getting enough from the airplay that they get on Spotify.
That's right. And, you know, we're talking about, we were just talking about promotion and how to use certain vehicles as promotion, whether it's theatrical, you know, exhibition for motion pictures, or here, Spotify, for an artist like an indie band. What a lot of these artists are finding is that if you're a label act, okay, great. You made some money because Spotify had to pay all of these licenses up front to the labels, right?
What was the news? Let's start with
the news here is that this Robin Davey, who was writing on Hypebot, who's a musician himself, he says, look, use Spotify as you do all other free streaming services like a Reverb Nation or a MySpace or a Root Music or SoundCloud. Put two or three of your songs up and try to entice people who are using those services to come to your own website where they will be able to discover more and pay more. And he then refers to Paul McGinnis, the manager of U2, who said that at this stage, Spotify is only a promotional tool. He's found, now this is Robin Davey, that even though there are a million more subscribers to Spotify at the end of 2011 than there were at the beginning.
They added another million subscribers in 2011.
Right. That really, it only added about one-tenth of a penny to the streaming royalties paid out to him. So for every,
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, so every time his song played, he made one-tenth of a penny more than previously. So he made about actually half of a cent every time his song streamed instead of four-tenths of a percent of a cent.
You're saying despite a much bigger audience, he's still not, his royalty rates are barely budging.
Correct. He finally got up to half a cent every time his song gets played.
Well, if the song got played a million times, which happens on the radio a lot, that'd be $500,000? No, how much would that be? Half a cent would be
$5,000
or something like that.
Exactly. So you just hit the nail on the head. Your song gets played a million times and you've made $5,000?
So Spotify is a big service. A lot of people subscribe to it. I walked into several homes of my friends and they were all using it, which was a change. I've not seen that before. A number of people now use Spotify. They're checking out old albums, listening to new albums. They do it all the time. And he's saying, hey, just like on MySpace, where you would find just two or three songs from a new album, he's saying artists should do that on Spotify. Some acts hold back their album for like 6 months and let the CD sales be the first leader. They want to create a window. Others, like Robin Davies, say, hey, if you take two or three songs, maybe your first two or three singles, allow Spotify to put them on the air. You'll make some tiny, tiny royalty. But hopefully also people will hear your music and then be drawn to go search out your website and pay for the whole album. You know, it's just like putting music on the radio. You don't put every track on the radio, usually. You normally, you know, just put two or three singles. So he's saying that's how you should use Spotify. That's his approach. Makes sense to me.
That makes sense to me, too. Why don't we move on to, unfortunately, some sad news. This was not a very good week for artists. Mike Kelly, a big artist here in the, you know, contemporary artist, he committed suicide. Ben Gazzara died, the actor. And then Soul Train creator Don Cornelius died in an apparent suicide. It looks like he shot himself.
Yeah, he was suffering. He had ill health and was had numerous personal problems, I guess. But he had been quite ill and quite pain for quite a while. So this seems like he was. How old was he? He was
75.
Yeah, he was 75 and quite a bit of pain, apparently. So it's very sad news. He was, of course, a major innovator on television. He created Soul Train. And that was a huge, huge hit show that brought a lot of black music to the rest of America for decades. And, you know, he stopped hosting, I think, in 93, but it still continued on Soul Train through 2006. So
it's 13 years past his hosting. Yeah.
A big, big player in entertainment, you know, right alongside Dick Clark's American Bandstand. This was a show where black people, this is our show. And he really, you know, made the African-American community and brought their audiences to their creators to a whole new level of audience that they didn't have before.
Well, yeah. And it was and I'm going to correct you on just one thing in a moment, but it was the longest running first run nationally syndicated show in television history. That's something that's kind of, I think, not known. I didn't know that.
No, I didn't know that either.
And he wasn't sick. He really was depressed.
I thought he'd been in poor health and was in physical pain. That was what I read on an early version. But I mean, you know, these things change as you as details emerge. So he was just in a mentally ill.
Yeah, he was not well. I guess yes, that would be considered mentally ill.
If you take your life, you're.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a friend of mine worked for him, and it was, you know, was with him the night before. I was with him every single night, knew that something was wrong, that he was very depressed, kept finding guns under the pillow and around the house, but, you know, had that sneaky suspicion. And it's interesting to me how people won't go, you know what, this person needs help.
Well, it's hard to know.
Yeah.
You know, when to get involved in someone's life. And, you know, I'm sure if he said, I'm about to kill myself, then you would probably act and tell somebody else and do something. But, you know, when you see someone seems unhappy, you know, it's hard to know what to do. You're not a trained professional. You're not a trained person. I certainly wouldn't hold that person. They shouldn't feel any guilt. I'm sure they feel bad and sad about it, but, you know.
Yes, no.
He's responsible for his own actions, assuming he was not so mentally incapacitated that he acted without, you know, his full faculties. But very sad passing. Terrific innovator on television and in music.
Yeah, well, certainly the show was a big deal.
That's right. Let's move right on to Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Okay, well, Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Bon Iver turns down the Grammys. That's right. Don't look for Bon Iver to perform on Sunday night's Grammys. The band was asked to take part by collaborating with another act, but refused. We just felt like it was such a large stage. We're getting nominated for this record that we made, said the band leader, Justin Vernon. Me and Brian Joseph and a bunch of I'm not going to say that word, but let's just say it starts with an F, effing friends. And we were given accolades for it. And all of a sudden, we were being asked to play music that had nothing to do with that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I'm not sure what he was asked. I mean, whether he was asked to play a tribute to somebody else. If he says music, nothing to do with it, I assume he was not asked to perform a track from their album. But this is how the Grammys deal. They try to create collaborations and, you know, moments that wouldn't have occurred elsewhere or hadn't occurred before, you know, different acts coming together. Some people do get solo performances. Sometimes they play just a minute or two of their song and then somebody else. You know, they're just trying to get as many acts as they can. It's a shame that they won't be on the show. It's a big whoop in general. And, you know, like last year, the year before, Mumford and Sons had a great moment. You know, they were there. They played a piece of a music. The Abbott Brothers did, and then they both backed Bob Dylan. It was one of the highlights of the show. So, you know, these collaborations, which are not, you know, typical, can be really great and a really great spotlight for an artist. And I'm just sorry Bon Iver wouldn't take part. And I'm sorry it wasn't in a way that they felt like it was one that they could be happy about taking part in.
Yeah, and I mean, Mumford & Sons, that was a career-launching moment. I mean, they had already been pretty popular, but I mean, they really took off after their Grammy performance.
Yeah, a spotlight on the Grammys is very valuable. So obviously Bon Iver felt like it was not the right situation. If they said, hey, we want you to play a song by ABBA, and it's like maybe they say, well, that doesn't feel like the right fit. But it's certainly not an insult to be asked to be on the Grammys and collaborate with somebody else unless you felt like they were beneath you somehow.
Well, you know who will be performing at the Grammys is Adele.
That's right.
And Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. You don't want to get me started on my attempt to purchase tickets for Bruce Springsteen's show and now shows here in Los Angeles, because it'll just be me complaining.
Well, let's move on.
Let's move on to a classic graphic novel, Watchmen, which is getting prequels. Who watches The Watchmen? I'll tell you, the first movie was just god-awful. Apparently, a lot of
talking about the book, okay, not the movie.
Apparently, a lot of talented artists read this book. After 25 years and against the wishes of its co-creator, Alan Moore, DC Comics is finally expanding on the world created in Watchmen, the groundbreaking graphic novel that is still the all-time bestseller in the genre. Artist Dave Gibbons has given his blessing to the project, which includes multiple prequels exploring the backstories of the main characters from the novel, which depicted a world where humans had violently turned against superheroes. That work is the holy grail of superhero comics, and after all this time to see the characters of Night Owl, Dr. Manhattan, and the rest given new storylines and adventures is either sacrilegious, awesome, or most likely both at the same time to most fans. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a very big deal. It's a huge project. It's going to be launching all year long. There's a lot of talented people involved. I can't have anything but mixed feelings about this. They left it alone for 25 years. Comic books have a long history of playing with their characters. I mean, The Dark Knight is one of the great graphic novels, and that certainly is a reworking of a character that had existed before, created by other people. Alan Moore has objected, but as somebody said in one of the interviews, well, that's a bit rich coming from a guy whose latest series, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, involves characters based on Jules Verne characters and H.G. Wells characters and all these other characters who existed, you know, in other works from other artists. But, you know, those were characters like Tom Sawyer and The Invisible Man that existed, you know, 100 years ago, and their creators are gone. So it is a little different. It makes me sad, and yet I'm really interested to see it as well. So I guess I'm one of those ambivalently excited people about The Watchmen.
Yeah, can we actually use that as the poll quote? Michael Gilt says he's ambivalently excited.
Maybe not the best-selling point.
You know, this next story I always knew was true. Harry Potter was a drunk. No more butterbeer for Daniel Radcliffe. Thank you very much. The star of the Harry Potter movies is proving so successful, what with his Broadway run and How to Succeed, and the new hit thriller, The Woman in Black, in theaters, that someday we may not even begin every sentence with Harry Potter when we refer to him. But for all level-headed business sense in mapping out a post-Harry career, Radcliffe does admit he was drinking too much and has sworn off alcohol without touching a drop for the past year and a half. Radcliffe says it happened because he spent so much time around people who were much older than him and that he was a messy drunk and not very appealing. And this is a quote, "I'm very good fun for the first four drinks, and then after that it's a rapid, rapid decline into where I have to be helped home. Blackout was kind of my thing," he admitted sheepishly to The Hero Complex, the LA Times blog about all things cool-headed by our good friend Jeff Boucher. He's the master over there at The Hero Complex. Is this new teetotaling Daniel Radcliffe a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in general. You know, it's his personal life, and I don't really care. I'm glad to hear he's felt like he was unhealthy and is now being healthy. The one thing I thought was interesting was that he said that a number of newspapers in the UK almost reported on his antics, if you want to call it that. I'm not quite sure how hard drinking he was or how messed up he was, but they almost reported on it, but didn't. And I think that plays into the idea that sometimes newspapers and like the tabloids in the UK and elsewhere get invested in the idea of someone. You know, he was that British lovely lad, Harry Potter. And you'd think they'd be chomping at the bit to show him drunk and throwing up in the gutter. But apparently they had too much invested in the idea of him as a nice, squeaky, clean emblem of England. And they didn't want to mess up that image. So it's funny how these things play out. Somebody else could have started to get tagged as a reckless, out-of-control lunatic, and that would follow them for years and maybe feed into them behaving like a lunatic, like Amy Winehouse or something. But in this case, they sort of just turned the other way and waited for him to straighten himself out.
Yeah, and he did. I mean, I think the biggest issue was that there were a few scenes where he said, you know, that scene in Harry Potter, I could tell, I think I was drunk in that scene. But why don't we move on to Random House, which is raising prices to libraries who will pay for ebooks. Random House is charging libraries more now for ebooks, and librarians are thrilled. Publishers and libraries are in a struggle over how to deal with ebooks. Some publishers refuse to sell to libraries. Others place crazy restrictions on lending. Others limit what titles will be included, and so on. But Random House, the biggest publisher in the U.S., allows unrestricted sales and lending to their ebooks. They expect libraries to pay more, especially since, unlike hardcover ebooks, they will never wear out. But they're committed to libraries. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? Or I know the answer to this, so can we just move on?
It's a very big deal. Libraries are a huge repository. They need to be able to share books and have books available to all of their community. If they were cut of the ebook world, it would be a real, real blow to their system. And Random House is showing a lot of smarts and partnering with them, figuring out the best royalty rate. Libraries always paid more for hardcovers. They would get those plasticky covers on them.
Yeah.
Remember those things? They paid more for hardcovers because they lent them out so much and they wore out and they had to buy more copies. But, you know, they got so much more wear and tear and they got seen by so many more people than the usual hardcover that they did pay extra. So it makes sense to charge extra for ebooks. But you want to come up with the right formula rather than refusing to work with libraries at all, which is what some other publishers are doing. And I think Random House is leading the way and being pretty smart.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like in the home video industry back when there was VHS rather than DVD. You'd either price for rental or you price for sell through. And if you price for rental, each copy of the VHS, you know, each VHS movie would cost $99.
Right.
And so Blockbuster would pay $99 for, you know, 2,000 of these videos. And, you know, that's how they made their money. Eventually, it would come down to sell through. This next story, Michael, I picked just for you. It's about a new George Harrison app for the iPad. The late lamented George Harrison of the Beatles will appear in a new app. His son, is it Donnie or Danny?
Danny.
Danny, who looks, by the way, exactly like his dad, created the app which allows you to take a virtual tour of Harrison's musical instrument collection, including his many guitars and ukuleles. Director, it wasn't director Steven, is it Spielberg? No. That can't possibly be right. Steven Sebring.
Oh, I thought it was Steven Spielberg.
No, no, it was Steven Sebring.
Who's
photographer.
Steven Sebring?
He's a photographer. And he took these 360-degree pictures of each instrument, so you can like zoom in and whip around it and look at it from all angles. You can like examine every nick and scratch. It comes out on February 23rd, 2 days before what would have been Harrison's 69th birthday, and it will cost $10. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. I don't understand why it's $10. I mean, frankly, it sounds like a fun little thing. It should just be put out in the world. I mean, it's like a one-time thing that, I mean, it's cool, but really? It sounds like an extra that you would see on in a DVD or something. It's just, I mean, $10 just to look at his instruments. I just thought it's a cool thing that he did, but it just, I mean, it should be free. Like, hey, everybody, I love my dad. Check out his cool instruments. It just seems like something, it just felt very non-George Harrison-y. I don't think they're trying to capitalize and make a ton of money. I don't think they anticipate a ton of demand for this. I think it probably cost quite a bit to create, I imagine. It's probably complicated, but I don't care. $10 just sounds weird.
Well, anything Beatles sells, so why, you know, I guess that's
I love the Beatles, but this just sounded weird to me.
You know, gamers are taking over the world, though, so you can understand why they're trying to make some money on apps.
That's the worst segue ever. Keep going.
Okay, well, I tried to segue us into our next story.
There's no need to segue.
All right. Well, in what may be a corporate first, the leader of a gaming division has taken over Sony Corp. Of course, gamers have been the head of gaming companies like Nintendo, but this may be the first time a diverse multinational like Sony will be headed by a dude who plays with joysticks all day long. Oh my gosh, you want to talk about betting anyway. Kazi Rai, 51. Says that he will focus on digital imaging, TV, innovation, and of course, smart mobile and games. He replaces Sir Howard Stringer, the first foreigner to ever run Sony. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And I should say the first non-Japanese CEO that they had.
Howard Stringer. Well, isn't that what we mean by foreigner?
Well, we never said that Sony was a Japanese company.
Ah, well, okay. for people in the future, aliens, will be more specific. I'm going on a limb here. I believe he is the first gamer to head up a non-gaming company or a company that encompasses a lot more than games. I didn't read that in this story that we linked to, and I've tried to look elsewhere, and I haven't been able to nail that down. But I think it's probably the first time, and it's probably close to it, and I think it shows how important gaming is, and it shows how it's such a big player in the world that being ahead of that division is just as good as being head of the music division or the movie division or anything else. You know, it's a multi-billion-dollar business on its own. So I think that's true. If anybody will let us know if it's not, we'd love to hear about somebody else in gaming who went on to head, you know, Time Warner or something else. But very cool news, I think.
Yeah, Kazzy Rai has been kind of groomed for some time to take over for Howard Stringer, who was kind of a little bitter on leaving during the press conference. He was kind of, he gave some very curt answers. But let's face it, Sony's struggling, and they have to turn around their television sales are just flagging. They've kind of bottomed out. And so he's got his work cut out for him. Now, speaking of people who have their work cut out for them and maybe a little bitter upon leaving, Warner Music Group is going to oppose the EMI merger with Universal and Sony. And this came from Edgar Bronfman, who was on his way out. If Warner Music Group doesn't get to play with the new shiny toy, then no one else should either. That's the essential stance of Warner Music Group about the sale of EMI to Sony and Universal. Outgoing chairman Edgar Bronfman, as I just mentioned, said that even though the company tried to buy EMI itself, it would now oppose the sale because that would stifle innovation and reduce payments to artists. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a little hard to take them seriously since they tried to buy it themselves.
Right. So, you know, Bronfman's problem is, oh, you're going to reduce the big record labels down from 4 to 3. Well, yeah, you tried to do the same thing, actually. So I don't see why it's okay when you do it and not when they do it.
They are smaller than Universal and Sony, though. Is that his point, I imagine?
Yes, precisely.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, everybody digs Ryan Seacrest. Okay, he may not be as talented as jazz pianist Bill Evans, but everybody in business with the talented TV host, DJ, and entertainment producer certainly wants to stay in business with him. Seacrest is launching a cable channel and has been tagged as a possible future host for the Today Show on NBC when Matt Lauer's contract expires. Meanwhile, his radio show partner Clear Channel is doubling down on him, committing $300 million to a fund for developing projects with Seacrest and investing in all his endeavors. They're also taking a minority stake in Seacrest Production Company. So even if all his commitments mean Seacrest has to move or end his radio show, Clear Channel will still be working with and profiting from their relationship with him. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. He's a growing media mogul. And if you are launching a cable channel, you do need big partners with access to content. So I think this is a big long-term play here. You know, he partners with Clear Channel. He has his radio show. It's a big part of who he is. But when they've got that venue that they want to fill with acts to show on their cable channel performing live concerts, it's good to be in bed with Clear Channel.
That is very true. I mean, they're just a behemoth. I just can't wait for them to finally figure out that Ryan Seacrest is a robot and doesn't sleep. I mean, how does this guy do so much?
Nothing to say.
All right. Well, you know what? This Facebook IPO thing that was announced last week, the one that we're not going to benefit from other than, you know, being members of Facebook or registered users. Guess who's going to become a billionaire because of it?
Maybe.
Well, yes, it's a beautiful day for investors when Facebook launches its IPO and U2's Bono may be one of the biggest winners. Bono owns a 1.5% stake in Facebook, and he's founder and on the board of Elevation Partners, a company that also owns a chunk of Facebook, as well as a chunk of Forbes, among other things. Bono's personal stake could easily be worth $500 million, while Elevation's stake is likely more than $1 billion. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. The rich get richer. Not to downplay Bono's smarts and investment. You know, he's a smart guy. He's done a lot of smart things, including being part of Elevation Partners. And he was in there early. I wonder how many other investments he made that didn't pan out. But that's sort of the roll of dice you get to take when you got a lot of money. But more power to him.
Yeah, I mean, I found it remarkable that he could make more on the Facebook investment than he made with U2 during his entire career.
I mean, I wonder how much he has made with U2 in his entire career. That would be an interesting thing to know. I guess it hasn't been $500 million. Is that the argument?
Probably not. Not just him personally.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is that when you are a part of U2 and you make tens of millions of dollars, $100 million, $200 million, then you've got money to create an equity firm like Investor. You know, I mean, it's like it is part of being in you too. You get to create a company like Elevation Partners because you have a spare $30 million to invest in it. You know,
good point. Yes.
But it all came from the fact that it was a lad with three cords and the truth.
Oh my gosh. Well, on that note, we should probably move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, today we're going to be joined by Jonathan Handel, who is a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter and an entertainment attorney at Troy Gould in Los Angeles. His law practice focuses on digital media, traditional entertainment, and technology. He blogs on these subjects and entertainment labor at Digital Media Law and on the Huffington Post and on Forbes.com.
For Bono,
of all,
yeah. Bono owns a piece of Forbes.
Good point. Now, his book, Hollywood on Strike, was published last year and focuses on Hollywood labor unions. Jonathan, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks very much. And I'd be remiss if I didn't plug an upcoming book, if I could ask your indulgence. It's Entertainment Residuals, A Full-Color Guide. It's the first book of its kind in color or black and white. It explains residuals.
Not in 3D?
Not in 3D. That will come next, and there'll be a pair of glasses. But, you know, it actually would benefit from that, come to think of it, because it's a multidimensional problem. What medium are you making something for? What medium are you reusing something in? And then what union are you talking about? So 3D or holograms wouldn't be bad, but it uses color to explain residuals, as I say, in a comprehensive and comprehensible manner. Starts from the very first sentence, assuming you don't know what residuals are, and takes you through a detailed examination of the formulas and the reuse patterns and then the economics and the arguments pro and con about residuals. And it's really some history grids. It really attempts to fill a gap. And I think it's something that anyone who's active in entertainment labor or who wants to understand their own residuals will find useful.
Well, now, both of your books, both the one that's about to be published in Hollywood on Strike, which was published last year and covered the 2007 Writers Guild strike and the SAG stalemate, are about labor unions. And now we have two big powerhouse Hollywood unions, the Screen Actors Guild and AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, are getting married. They're merging. Why are they doing this after all of these years?
Well, we don't know for sure if they're going to consummate the merger, as it were. The stage we're at now is that the members of each union have to vote, and it takes a 60% vote of those voting in each union separately calculated to pass merger. Now, they've tried most recently in 1998 and 2003 in both of those occasions. AFTRA voted above the 60%. SAG in 98 fell short of 50. In 2003, it fell just short of 60%, 2% below. That led to something of a backlash against the merger folks that put the anti-merger folks in power. And those were the people who did, in fact, engage in the SAG stalemate in the wake of the Writers Guild strike. SAG politics can be very cyclical. There was a backlash against that. And for the last four election cycles, folks who've campaigned on a strictly pro-merger platform, that's it's just been merger, have gotten elected, and in the last two cycles, overwhelmingly. Now, why merger? Merger has been discussed, actually, since these unions were founded in the 1930s, and the question was, why do we have two, or actually three, counting Actors Equity, the Stage Actors Union, why exactly do we have three performers unions?
Yeah, I mean, I wondered that myself, because, I mean, if you look at, say, the auto industry, you have the United Auto Workers Union. You don't have the United Auto Workers Union and then those workers who just work on, you know, SUVs.
Well, you know, it's funny. For a moment, I misheard what you were saying, and I heard you say mistakenly the audio industry. And in fact, there are two industries, two unions. One is the American Federation of Musicians, and the other actually is AFTRA. AFTRA, in addition to actors, represents newscasters and also singers in the sound recording, the music business, as well as singers in television. And so when you download something from iTunes, especially a track from a major label, you're listening to the results of the front man or front woman being an AFTRA member, the singer, and the musicians backing him or her up being AFM members. So that's an interesting aspect that becomes more front and center in Hollywood consciousness if and when the unions do merge. Now, why two unions? It's buried in history. You know, New York and L.A. back in the 30s were very distant cities. You didn't really have at least reasonably priced transcontinental air travel. People would send telegrams. Long-distance phone calls were ferociously expensive. There really was a distance that there isn't now, even, you know, even between countries. Just pick up the phone and, you know, let's just call England. What the hell? Or let's do it on Skype. And the Screen Actors Guild started in Screen. AFTRA started as AFRA, American Federation of Radio Artists, started in the radio industry in New York and to some extent Chicago. And, you know, when television was developed, there was this sort of naive feeling that, oh, that'll unify us all. And in fact, it did exactly the opposite. You ended up with shared jurisdiction or overlapping jurisdiction between SAG and AFTRA in television in a way that's evolved, especially as production's gone digital and especially as we've gotten cable TV, pay cable and basic cable into the mix, and now the internet. So something that was problematic from the early 50s when there were disputes and there was something called the Television Authority, grandiosely named, that existed for a couple of years before merging with AFRA to form AFTRA. You know, it's probably more history than any, you know, you look at it and you go, well, you know, the 50s, 70 years ago, I mean, that's, you know, my father or grandfather's or great grandfather's age. What the, you know, what the heck? But the long reach of history, the long arm of history has extended into the 21st century. And merger is a contested matter. But as I say, the merger supporters have been overwhelmingly elected. And the members really are signaling that they're just over and done with this kind of thing.
So we have two unions that have formed for a lot of reasons. One was on the East Coast, one was on the West Coast, because there was sort of a physical separation. We have industries like radio and movies and television and music and online, all of which seem like separate worlds, which have all sort of come together in many ways, especially in the digital world. And it's possible and likely, I think, that they will merge. If SAG and AFTRA do merge, they'll be bigger and larger than ever. What will that allow them to do? What would be first on their agenda as a combined union?
Well, your summary is exactly right. And first on their agenda actually will be implementing the merger. It's not as easy as snapping one's fingers.
It's like moving all your stuff into a new home, figuring out what goes where, who's in charge of which board.
Well, that's right. I mean, a new home, luckily they've, you know, AFTRA moved its headquarters to LA a few years ago, about in 2007, actually. So they're in the same building on different floors, which, you know, when they were in conflict, must have led to some difficult elevator rides. But the relationship is, you know, is much, much better now. And yeah, the board will be a combined board of about 150 people transitionally for about a year. There'll be co-presidents, there'll be co-national executive directors. The NED is the top paid staff person. You know, there'll be merging departments, you know, yada, yada, yada. The big issue also, and one that's a bit of a, you know, not a joker in the deck, but a problematic thing, is merging the unions does not automatically merge the pension and health plans. Those are separate legal organizations, jointly governed by a board of trustees that's jointly 50-50 management and labor. It's a legal requirement. And the difficulty is that, you know, you don't know, there are a lot of complexities in terms of the actuarial, you know, the numbers and economics of merging these things, the legalities. It is doable. Many, many multi-employer plans, and these are multi-employer, they cover, you know, all companies in the industry, have merged in the past. But the boards of trustees are 50-50, and they are independent. And one of the reasons for merger is that people have been undergoing a split earnings problem. As television has moved to AFTRA, and as I just reported in The Hollywood Reporter, and you can go to THR Labor, The Hollywood Reporter, in other words, THRLabor.com, to get a redirect to our labor page.
This is a great story, that when SAG threatened to go on strike in 2008, Basically, all the TV networks gave all their business to AFTRA, and where SAG used to dominate TV pilot season, now AFTRA is dominating the TV pilot season massively. And that's something that they won't be able to do anymore, sway back and forth to one union versus the other once these people merge.
Yeah, you know, actually, when that happened in 2008, I really felt like, well, merger then is only, you know, it's almost assured, because now that SAG doesn't really represent most of the television artists or most of the actors working on television, they have to merge.
Well, it's interesting. They actually, the existing schedule, it turns out, I was just inquiring about this, is about 50-50, or actually slightly in SAG's favor, because it takes time for new shows to displace old ones. But you're right, the new programming for the last 4 years, as I just reported the latest a day or two ago, has been a 180 from 2008. 2008 and the recent history before that was the pilots and the series pickups were about 90% SAG. Since then, they've been 80 to 90% AFTRA.
So are studios wary? Are they nervous about this merger, knowing that they're not going to be able to play one off the other, that suddenly they're not going to have any negotiating, well, hey, we can go to them if we don't go to you, that sort of thing?
Well, it's interesting. They you know, in the primetime stuff, it's not so much they've been playing one off the other. They've just abandoned SAG. And the irony is that the folks who hate and within SAG, the constituency that hated AFTRA the most, are one of the best things that happened to AFTRA in many years. And the producers, though, have continued to stay AFTRA. They won't have that choice. You're right. If the unions do merge, it'll be one union. And ironically, the AFTRA contract actually has minimums that are 3.5% higher than SAG's, because AFTRA did a deal in mid-08. SAG, because of the stalemate under that previous administration, didn't do its deal for almost a year later, and they missed out on 1 year's salary bumps. So management has really signaled, you know, that they'd rather see these unions weakened and separate. And I think that...
And management in this case is our networks and studios and broadcasters.
Yeah, network studios, broadcasters, producers, exactly, as represented by the AMPTP. I mean, so that's the inference, that they really would rather see them separate. You know, the merger opponents say, no, they'd rather see us together because the resulting union won't be as strong.
Wouldn't the resulting union be stronger than having two?
Because the merger opponents feel that AFTRA tended, in basic cable in particular, to cut more accommodating deals, and so they feel that the merged union will dilute what they see as SAG's harder line on things. I don't think so. And in fact, one thing that's interesting is that the proposed new constitution, they released the merger documents, several documents, last week, and I did a very extensive analysis, the only one out there. If you go to THR Labor and scroll down, you'll find it. The proposed constitution makes it somewhat easier for the new union to call a strike than SAG, than it is under SAG or AFTRA rules. So ironically, if that constitution had been in place in 08, the merger opponents who opposed the DGA, WGA, AFTRA new media template might have been able to get their 75% threshold and actually call a strike and be able to get more of what they wanted. So, you know, this is not, it's the new documents, the new structure is being attacked vociferously, but I think even from the standpoint of the membership first folks, the folks that, you know, take that position, that there are at least some aspects that that make for a stronger union. You know, and I don't want to be in the position of expressing an opinion on this. As a reporter for The Hollywood Reporter, you know, my job is to cover this even-handedly, and I have definitely tried to, and to present both sides of the arguments and, you know, stories that one side or the other side might rather not see in print. But I do think, in fairness, that at least on that issue, the strike threshold, that there was something there for the opponents to like, actually.
See, if you worked for Fox News, you could just state your opinion right at the beginning. It'd be so much easier for you rather than having to remain an impartial observer. But what we're talking about here is digital. I think that's probably going to be, once they merge and get all these technical issues out of the way about benefits and retirement funds and the such, I think this will be the order of business. I mean, this is what dominates all contract negotiations now. SAG and AFTRA, when they combine, will be focused on how much of a piece of the pie do we get. And as you said, historically, AFTRA has sort of been more accommodating. When a show gets syndicated on cable, they haven't been demanding the big cut of the residuals that maybe SAG has been pushing for, as big a cut. You have DVD, you have video on demand, you have streaming, you have all these new revenue streams that we're seeing for entertainment.
Well, I do.
Content.
I do have to jump in. Actually, the SAG and AFTRA formulas on the residuals grid that formed, it's on my website, and that sort of forms the basis for the book, are actually identical in all cases except in basic cable. And in fact, in some cases, the AFTRA formula is higher because of the higher minimums. But, you know, it's ironic. The issues actually have shifted to pension and health and not new media. The economy, the bottom dropped out of the economy, the stock market, healthcare costs are spiraling. And I
think 401k collapsed and they're a little nervous.
That's right. Yeah. In 2000, you know, this past negotiation was really about pension and health, not about new media. 2014 is going to be partially about P&H and partially about the conditions for merging the contracts, because the two sets of contracts will continue as separate contracts for the next couple of years, even though the unions have merged, until they both expire, at which time the unions are going to say, we want to merge these contracts.
Well, and that might be what the unions are focused on, but in a way, it's in management or the producer's best interest to keep it focused on that, because right now they've basically said, oh, we can't give you a bigger piece of the digital pie because we've got no idea what the digital pie has to offer. I think everybody realizes now, look, the digital pie at some point will be
the pie.
Yeah, it's the only thing left. So to say, oh, we don't know what it's going to offer, that may be true, but we want our fair share of it. They really should be focused on digital.
Well, it's tough, you know, because on one hand, there is that, and the fact that these formulas, you know, these contracts are sort of like roach motels. So contract clauses check in, but they don't check out, and so it becomes difficult in the future to alter these existing formulas. But the flip side is that there is very, very little money right now from new media, and there is very, you know, significant money and significant concern about the pension and health plans. I mean, these unions have health plans that everyone in the country should have. I mean, some people attack them, say they're gold-plated, blah, blah, blah. You know, everyone in this country really should be entitled to decent health care. And the entertainment unions are one of the few places where you've got that. Likewise, in the pension plans, these are pension plans that provide security for people in their old age and people who are, you know, who are not making much money. People look at SAG, they say, well, you know, rich person's union. No, the rich people, you know, the Tom Cruises and the George Clooney's, they, you know, get nothing out of SAG. Okay, I mean, they have tons of money. The 3% versus a 2% increase in minimums doesn't affect them. They're getting their 15 or 20 million or whatever it is, completely independent of that. Pension and health, well, you know, that's not a drop in the bucket when you've got that kind of money. So these are unions that really are focused on and that benefit middle class and struggling working class actors, writers, you know, even directors and below the line folks. So there is a sort of a bum rap that people outside the industry do give the unions.
Well, Jonathan, I would say that the digital isn't that difficult because you solved the problem in your last book, Hollywood Strike, where you talk about a simple, clear, and very straightforward way to deal with all these different revenue streams. Put them all in one big pie. And not worry about whether the money is made on Blu-ray or DVD or video on demand or download from iTunes. Just put it all in one big pie, and that's where you figure out what sort of money everybody who's a part of that should get. But one thing I wanted to ask you was, bigger is not always better. So what are the possible negative repercussions or the ungainliness that might result if and when SAG and AFTRA merge? What could be the downside to this, maybe for the actors or for the business in general?
Well, you know, it can be a trade-off. I mean, there will probably be administrative efficiencies and so forth, and, you know, at least one fewer oversized board once it cuts down to 80 rather than two boards of roughly that size. You know, in terms of the downside, I mean, I think that, you know, some newscasters and recording artists are concerned that this is going to be an actor-dominated union. Obviously, you know, this relatively small group of, you know, vigorous opponents to merger are concerned, as I mentioned, that there be a watered-down aspect to it. You know, I think on balance that this is a union that makes a lot, or uniting, that, well, I don't want to express an opinion, but there, you know, it certainly is, one can see a lot of sense to it. The downside for the industry, of course, is that a stronger union and a union that has a somewhat easier strike trigger, you know, is one that might strike, and there are difficult problems for both management, for the companies, and for labor, And when labor gets squeezed, it's harder for some people to look at that, especially when you have top management, you know, making $20, $30 million for the president of a studio. You know, that becomes emblematic of, you know, gee, these people are just making it up when they say they don't have the money. So it's a tough, you know, it's a tough dynamic in some ways.
Well, what does this mean for consumers? Will it mean anything for consumers in the long run, or is this all truly inside baseball and it's all about, you know, producers and broadcasters and big corporations versus actors and those who appear either on screen or basically are on air personalities?
I think this is primarily inside baseball, honestly. I mean, you know, whether this will drive some sort of change in the product mix for television, you know, push towards more reality or something like that. I think the union factor and things like that is really subsumed under production costs generally and consumer tastes. So unless there is a strike or a threat of a strike that interrupts the supply of product, you know, as you've seen, speaking of baseball and, you know, in sports and basketball and football, there were these threats recently, I guess. You know, I think that for consumers, it's a question of people who do love following inside baseball in the entertainment industry. And if they don't, just set the DVR and keep on watching and go to the theaters and start buying more tickets and we'll all be happy.
Well, Jonathan, thank you very much for taking the time to try and unravel this story for us and explain what a potential merger between SAG and AFTRA would mean, not only for consumers, but also mostly for the industry. I appreciate your time. Of course, we'll place links to all of your work. I don't know how you have time to even join us. You do so much. But thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
That's always great of him to join us. He knows a lot about the business. I liked his little mini history about SAG and AFTRA. The one thing I do take issue with is the idea that, you know, you say, well, these new media pieces, they're not always making a lot of money. And I always feel like, well, I don't care how much money you're making from video streaming or Blu-ray or, you know, video on demand or Hulu. It's like, I still want my cut of it. And I don't care that it's new or old, you know, a dollar's a dollar. If you make a dollar off Hulu, whatever the deal is with Hulu, you make a buck on it. I want my piece of the pie.
Right. Well, and as Congress has proven, as almost every industry has proven, that once a clause gets or a law gets approved or a clause gets put into a contract, it's really hard to change it. And that's what Jonathan was.
Don't laws change all the time?
Well, they change all the time, but not without a lot of fighting.
Yeah.
Right. Well.
Well, but it was fascinating. I can't imagine this not going through. I imagine this merger will happen. Seems to me it's going to, don't you think?
I think this time it does seem like it's actually going to happen. Certainly all the reporting, some of which is being done by Jonathan Handel, it really does seem like, you know what, at this point it's going to go through. There doesn't seem to be a real reason to have both SAG and AFTRA around. So combining does seem like the smart move here.
And if you've got a spare $1,600 before they merge, you can go to AFTRA, their website, AFTRA.org or .com or whatever it might be, and you can become a member of AFTRA, even if you don't have any stage or film or theater or radio credits. You can just go in and sign up and become a member. That will end after the merger becomes official, but anybody who's in there already will be grandfathered in. That's what our understanding is. And, you know, frankly, if I had the money and pay that and the annual fees of a couple hundred dollars, I would probably do it just for the retirement benefits.
That's a good point. And speaking of good points, we should make a point of telling you that you can head on over to iTunes and rate and review our show as well as subscribe. Or you could subscribe on the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher or in your RSS reader or your favorite podcatcher. Rate and review our shows on all of those places, please. It really does help us out. You can also email us. Our email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us. Our number is toll-free, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to Jonathan Handel's work, as well as all of the stories that we discussed on today's show, can be found in the show notes for episode 135 on our website. That is showbizsandbox.com. So that's where you'll find all of our email address and contact information and ways to subscribe, as well as ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook. Our username is Showbiz Sandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. Michael, you want to tell everyone what it is?
Why do you always ask me that? It's michaelgiltz.com. You can say that.
Yeah.
Do you think you're talking too much and I need to chime in for a moment just so they know I'm still here and not off having lunch?
Yes, precisely. Yes. So,
okay. michaelgiltz.com.
So go there so that Michael can finally have some lunch. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. And until next week, play nice.